This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. Humans and birds don't have much in common. For example, most birds can fly, and most humans can't. But one thing we do have in common is that humans and birds both love to play tourist in New York City. Every year, millions of birds fly through New York on their annual migration. And because flying several thousand miles is pretty exhausting, these birds nest for a few days in one of NYC's many urban parks.
I live really near Brooklyn Bridge Park, and I basically walked in the park almost every day of the pandemic. But I always saw it through the eyes of, you know, somebody who's an architecture critic. But I never really perceived it as a bird habitat.
This is design critic and friend of the show, Alexandra Lang.
I would see people, you know, tweeting pictures of birds from Brooklyn Bridge Park. And so I'd think, oh, I should, you know, notice those. But it's like I didn't know how to notice them.
Alexandra wanted to know more about the birds passing through her city and wrote an article about it for the website CityLab. Last November, she emailed two local birders, and they showed her all the birds quietly nesting in her favorite park.
And then we had the ravens nest. Did you hear about that?
Mm-hmm.
So the ravens nested on the tower of the Brooklyn Bridge.
Oh.
And that's the third ever on record raven nest.
They showed me this bird that they called the butter butt.
There's one.
Oh, I see. Okay. So like the
butt. Some people call them butter butts.
Its real name is the yellow rump warbler, just FYI. I don't know if that's any more dignified than butter butt, but you know.
It was so fun to see just that like flash of bright yellow in the park. You know, it was already November, like everything was very gray and brown and kind of sere. And just to have somebody point and see that like flash of yellow, that was just great.
But as Alexandra walked through the park, she noticed something else, something that unnerved her. While Brooklyn Bridge Park is a safe haven for birds, the park is surrounded by condos and hotels and office buildings with floor-to-ceiling windows. These all-glass building facades are the absolute worst for migrating birds. Because unlike people, birds don't really understand glass.
I mean, this has happened in cities all over the U.S. and all over the world, that there's been this boom in urban parks, but those parks booms also spur real estate development. It's glass buildings, because those are what we think of as fancy new architecture.
Anytime you have glass and birds in the same space, you have a risk of bird window collisions.
This is Caitlin Parkins, the interim director of conservation and science at New York City Audubon.
I often hear people say, oh, birds are so dumb, they just run into glass. Why don't they see it? And if you step back and think of it, it's made not to be seen, right? It's made so that we can look through our window and get a beautiful view of the outdoors. We see glass because we use architectural cues to recognize that it's present, or we've learned some of the nuance of the color of glass, or maybe there's a mark on the glass that makes us realize, okay, this is a solid barrier.
Birds can't really pick up on those cues. This is especially bad if there's anything behind the glass the bird recognizes, like a plant.
So if you can imagine a really reflective piece of glass and there's a tree in it, a bird is going to see that and recognize it as a tree and try to fly to it. And they're very fast and they hit very hard and often they die instantly. Another example, this is a ecological trap, but we put vegetation behind glass. We love atriums with trees in them. We want to bring nature indoors. Well, then you're actually just putting a clear piece of glass between a tree and a bird. And of course, they're going to try to fly to the tree and rest and hit the glass and potentially die.
The world is incredibly perilous for birds. Windmills kill birds. So do cars and trucks. And on top of that, pet cats kill so many birds. Truly. Cats are out of control. However, it's believed that building collisions are one of the biggest causes of bird death. Birds crash into buildings during the day because they don't see the glass, and they run into buildings at night because they are lured in by artificial lighting. Most of these collisions happen below 100 feet because that's where birds are used to landing in trees. This loss is awful for so many reasons. Birds are essential for controlling pests and pollinating flowers and regenerating forests. And watching birds and listening to birdsong is just really nice. We don't have exact numbers on how many birds we kill because there is no bird census. But even the lowest estimates are devastating.
According to the Audubon Society, buildings kill 300 million to a billion birds per year. Like a billion birds. I mean, that's the high end of the estimate. Like, these are definitely, like, I noticed when I was looking back through the stats, very broad estimates, but it's a lot of birds.
These collisions are a major reason the bird population in North America is in decline. One study found that we've lost 3 billion birds since the 1970s. Again, we don't have exact numbers, which is why organizations around the world hold collision walks. Every week, groups like NYC Audubon organize volunteers to document the number of dead birds next to skyscrapers. Here's Caitlin Parkins.
It started back in 1997 when one of our board members started just noticing dead birds on the sidewalk and actually didn't even know what was causing it. And she and some volunteers started walking the streets, documenting bird window collisions, picking up dead birds, and of course, transporting injured birds to rehabilitation centers. So when our volunteers find a bird that's been stunned, they put it into a paper bag, and a paper bag is the best transport vehicle. They're like little bird ambulances.
If you want to see this in action, there's a video on YouTube of Caitlin helping stun birds in a New York City park.
Sort of let the bird out and let it choose to leave when it wants to. So I'm just going to open this bag. This bird is ready, ready, ready to go.
We actually don't know how many of those birds makes it. We expect that many of them, even if they recover from the immediate trauma, probably have long-term trauma and probably often don't make it much further.
According to Caitlin, stunned and wounded birds are the exception. Most birds that collide with buildings are killed instantly. The Audubon volunteers spent a lot of their time picking up dead birds and bringing them back to a freezer at their office in Manhattan.
Eventually, those carcasses get donated to museums for museum collections. It's kind of a nice way of having these birds go to some sort of useful scientific or educational purpose because they were needlessly killed, but it somehow feels a little bit better that at least they're going towards some greater good.
Still, these collision walks are really difficult for the volunteers and staff at NYC Audubon. Caitlin Parkins vividly remembers a day last fall that lives in New York birder infamy, October 6th, 2021.
There was really heavy migration. There was also a pretty intense storm and low cloud cover, and that brings birds down low into the city. So I started getting text messages around 6:30 in the morning. Volunteers were saying, I can't pick up all of these birds. I'm watching birds hit. I'm trying to pick up the stunned birds. I need help. I had a black pole warbler die in my hand. I watched it hit a window at Columbus Circle. And I picked it up, and it was convulsing in my hand, and there's nothing that I could do in that moment. I knew that bird was going to die.
The bird collisions that day were especially traumatic for volunteers in downtown Manhattan, particularly those who monitor the new towers at the World Trade Center site. Tower 4 is designed by Japanese architect Fumihiko Maki, and it's known as Bird Enemy Number 1 because of its design. The tower is basically a floor-length mirror of a building, and it's in exactly the wrong place.
The other aspect of why that particular site is deadly is the memorial grove of trees around the footprint fountains for the deaths on 9/11. Those are a very broad tree canopy that's right in close proximity to these buildings.
That morning, a volunteer for NYC Audubon named Melissa Breyer got to the World Trade Center buildings, and what she found became big news around the world.
Thousands of birds are being found.
She went to the World Trade Center site, and she found over 200 dead birds there that day. And she actually arranged them in kind of a grid and attached the photos to the tweet. And I really think it went viral because seeing, you know, that many like tiny, fragile dead birds all in one tweet was just very overwhelming.
It was picked up on Twitter. It was picked up by the media. We started getting all kinds of media inquiries. As terrible as that event was, it brought a lot of awareness to the issue.
This is clearly like not an acceptable state of affairs. These are really some of the newest, shiniest buildings in New York. Why are we allowing them, you know, to do this to birds?
When it comes to bird collisions, there's a lot we can do. For nighttime collisions, we can turn off lights in empty skyscrapers, which are tempting for migrating birds. And for daytime collisions, good design can go a long way. In fact, there are design solutions that can bring down bird deaths by 80 or 90%. And they're pretty straightforward. It's all about making buildings more legible for birds. You can break up an all-glass facade with colored fins or solid barriers, or you can design a building with bird-safe glass that's covered in patterns or small dots so a bird doesn't see the glass as transparent. According to Alexandra Lang, there are many great examples of bird-safe design on the New York skyline.
Like, I think one of the best examples is the New York Times building, which was designed by Renzo Piano and has this exterior screen of ceramic rods, which are 2 inches or so apart. So that's a building that happens to be great for birds because they see the rods and they don't see the glass, and so they don't smack into it.
Today, many architects are consulting birders while planning new buildings around the country. One example is the Amazon campus that's being constructed in Northern Virginia. The original designs were less than ideal.
The centerpiece of this new Amazon campus that they're building in Virginia is this building called the Helix, which is a curving glass building with a path spiraling up the outside, and the whole path is going to be planted with trees. So for a bird, that basically means at any point from the bottom to the top of the building, they could easily get distracted, try to land on a tree, and smack into the glass.
Amazon hired a landscape architect named Kate Orff to work on the project. And right away, she noticed the serious problems with the facade.
Kate Orff is a birder, is somebody that's been a real activist on bird safety, helped to write some earlier guidelines with the Audubon Society. And so when she saw the design for this building, she was basically like, well, I can't be a party to this.
Say what you will about Amazon as a company, but they listened to Kate Orff and the birders on this one.
All of the glass that is adjacent to the trees on this building either has a frit or it's colored or there are external fins or spines that will be spaced, you know, 2 inches apart so that birds will perceive the building and not just smack into it.
It's not just architects and planners getting wise to bird safety. Cities are also adopting new rules about bird-safe design. Toronto approved regulations in 2010 that require new buildings to use 85% bird-safe glass on lower levels. And more recently, cities like New York and San Francisco have adopted similar rules. These new laws represent progress, but they can only do so much. And that's because these laws are focused on the design of new buildings. They don't address the thousands of glass structures that already exist.
It's certainly much easier to design a bird-friendly building than to fix it later. Not that it's necessarily hard, it's just additional cost.
Alexandra Lang says there are only a few examples of buildings that have gone ahead with large-scale retrofits, including the Javits Center in Manhattan. It's a huge convention center that runs right along the West Side Highway next to a park. Javits used to be a notorious bird killer. But a few years ago, the owners invested millions of dollars to replace all the glass in the building. The new glass is covered in tiny dots, spaced 2 inches apart. NYC Audubon says the renovations at Javits have reduced bird collisions by about 90%. But that's just for one building.
Like, I talked to several architects who know all about bird safety. And even they, in dealing with some clients, can't convince them to use bird-safe glass. There's such a prejudice on the part of clients, especially clients who are building luxury buildings, to think that they need floor-to-ceiling transparent glass. And they think that the people that are going to buy apartments in these buildings are not going to be satisfied with glass that has tiny little dots on it. So they say, no, like, we're not going to put that in. Like, we could live with the bird deaths.
But Alexander Lang says despite the resistance from designers, people get used to bird-safe glass pretty quickly.
It's really practically imperceptible to the human eye when you're inside the building that there are these teeny tiny dots on the glass.
Even if there were laws to fix every skyscraper in America, it would only address a small part of the bird collision problem, because our homes can have big glass windows too. And surprisingly, it's actually homes and low-rise buildings that account for a majority of bird collisions.
Which begs the question, why are we talking about the high-rises? Well, it's because a home or a low-rise building is not going to kill 200 birds in one day. But there are so many more homes and low-rise buildings in the U.S. than there are skyscrapers. So it's more the attrition of, say, your house with a big glass window killing 12 birds a year. But it turns out your neighbor's house also kills 12 birds a year, and the neighbor next to them, and the neighbor next to them.
The average person can't change the design of a skyscraper, but there are small fixes that can make your home bird safe.
If you, say, in your house have a big sliding glass door that birds keep running into, you can put stickers on that door. You can put a net over that door during prime flying season. At the very least, you should not install your bird feeder right in front of that giant glass door, because that makes it particularly deadly. So, yeah, there are a lot of inexpensive techniques that homeowners can use just to keep the birds away from their particular pane of glass.
And that's what's so compelling about this issue, as opposed to the complex, systemic, interconnected issues that we often talk about on this show. Bird collisions are a serious problem with a pretty simple design solution.
The reason I love design is because design is about problem solving. And this is a problem we know how to solve. We just have to get over some of our aesthetic preoccupations in order to solve it.
More words about birds with Kurt Kohlstedt after this. So I'm back with 99PI's own Kurt Kohlstedt to talk a little bit more about birds. Actually, there's quite a lot to talk about, because over the years, we've gotten a lot of fan suggestions for stories on the subject of birds.
Oh, yes. Yes, we have. And the funny thing is, back when I joined the show, like years ago, we actually had a rule on the books about 99PI covering animal-related stories.
The cardinal rule. No cardinals.
Exactly. The cardinal rule was no cardinals. And that also applied to other animals. It was just kind of a fun shorthand. Mm-hmm. But since then, we've talked about a lot of species, especially in relationship to, you know, humans and our built environment. And we've gotten a lot of pitches from listeners about animals. For some reason, birds most of all.
What is it about birds that gets people like suggesting stories for us?
Yeah, I suspect it's partly because bird strikes are such a visible and kind of a traumatizing part of living in cities. And so naturally, most of these stories that we do get involve bird deaths and like how to mitigate bird deaths. But it turns out that not everyone is on board with saving birds, or at least not every kind of bird.
Wait, well, who's anti-bird out there?
Right?
What are these cruel people?
Yeah,
no. Who can be anti-bird? Birds are delightful.
Right? But it turns out that some birds are actively targeted for destruction. And here in the U.S., there's one in particular, more than others, the starling, which isn't even native to North America.
Okay, so where do they come from if they're not from North America?
So back in the late 1800s, there was a German immigrant named Eugene Schieffelin, and he was on this mission to introduce birds to North America. But not just any birds. According to lore, he had a specific fondness for European species that had been written about by William Shakespeare. People who were introducing non-native birds, they really liked to cite him as inspiration. Like, he kind of jazzed people up about these birds. And so around the turn of the 20th century, there were a lot of groups that were aiming to make America look and feel more like Europe, in part by importing familiar plants and animals. And Eugene belonged to one of these groups. It was called the American Acclimatization Society.
Huh. So would they just import birds and just release them out in the wild and just kind of hope for the best?
Yeah, pretty much. And a lot of these foreign species failed to take off. But some of them, like the starling, turned out to be really adept survivors because starlings are highly competitive and they're really good at securing prime nesting spots that other birds would normally occupy.
Yeah. I mean, this is the story when it comes to introducing species. I mean, like, that sometimes they can sort of take over a niche and then they just crowd out all other birds.
That's exactly it. And scientists have observed exactly that correlation, that as starling populations increase, bluebird, woodpecker, and other bird populations decrease.
Yeah. So I can see why birders would be kind of anti-starling, you know, because they're a fan of other birds.
Right, right. They want some diversity. And they're not the only ones who are not totally on board with starlings, because it turns out starlings are also a really big pain for the agriculture industry. Not only do they eat grain that's meant for livestock, they're picky about it. They tend to eat the best grain. And this has secondary effects, right? Like reducing the dairy output of cows.
Yeah, I can see why farmers would have a problem with starlings if that was the case.
And on their behalf, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has stepped in to mitigate this problem. The USDA actually disperses or kills off millions of animals per year. And from the latest numbers I've seen, starlings are at the top of their hit list. In 2021, they took out thousands of brown tree snakes, tens of thousands of feral pigs, but nearly a million starlings.
Wow, that's significant. That's a lot.
Yeah, and on top of the ones they kill, they disperse millions more each year.
What does that mean? That sounds like a euphemism.
Well, basically, it's like they get them to move away from places that we don't want them, like farms. And they do this using a combination of, you know, recorded sounds and strobing lights, like anything that the birds would find scary and, you know, wouldn't want to be around.
Huh. And so do those efforts actually work?
Well, it's very much an uphill battle. Today, there are still around 200 million starlings in North America. Viewed in that light, the USDA's impact seems actually kind of small.
So we did a story a while back about how pigeons got introduced to North America. And, you know, now those are like the bird that most people think of as a nuisance, you know, because we run across them in cities. One of the things we talked about when we talked about pigeons is like, pigeons, it's all about attitude because they're called doves when they're not in cities. And so I wonder, are there people who, you know, see those starlings and don't see them as pests, you know, just see them as like cool birds because they do those like murmurations where they float through the sky and they're kind of stunning to, you know, to watch.
Yeah.
Are there people that are lobbying to protect them even though they're invasive species?
I mean, not exactly like lobbying to protect them as such, but there are people who point out that starlings might not be as bad for other birds as we think. And so maybe like our focus on, you know, killing starlings is kind of misplaced because there's a debate around the data, right? Regarding the impact they have on other bird species and this, you know, larger scientific question of correlation versus causation.
Right.
And so there's a related school of thought that maybe instead of running starlings out of town, we should build or grow more habitats for other birds, which, you know, makes sense.
Right. Right. Like we don't have to just kill off starlings. You know, we could just boost other birds and have a healthier ecosystem.
Yeah, that's the idea. But of course, farmers wouldn't be too thrilled about giving up the starling hunt, which leads me to another type of bird, one that farmers actually like to have around, owls.
So I take it that farmers probably like owls because they eat rodents and things like that.
Yeah. Historically, yes. We like it when birds do things for us. But there are some groups that have taken to, you know, building and putting up nesting boxes to help house species like displaced owls, which, you know, is independent of their utility to us humans.
Yeah, that is nice to see that we shouldn't just treat animals as, you know, valuable because they serve us in some ways. So it's nice that we are like making the built environment suitable for us and for them. Because actually, in the end of it all, like, it needs to be suitable for both us and them for it to be a good, healthy, like, joyful place to live.
Absolutely. And, you know, just one other thing before we go. There's a guy who wrote in from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and he had some really interesting insights, too, on, like, there are bricks that are specifically built to house certain kinds of birds that are, like, hollow. And he also noted that like a lot of birds get stuck in pipes. I mean, there's just on top of the windows that we kind of talked about in the main part of the story, there are just a lot of techniques out there that we could employ to just make the built environment like a happier place for all kinds of species.
Yeah. Yeah. This is one of those rare 99PIs where the design solution is sitting right there. You know, like if you just have those fritted glass, you could save so many bird lives, and it's the technology is there. It just has to be the will and, the willingness to like spend the money to do it. But, as windows get replaced, why not just like make everything just a little bit better for birds? That would be amazing.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And there are places in the world where it's like that's part of the mandate that cities have for new architecture, right? Like it's just like part and parcel of building a new building is just making it friendlier for animals as well as humans.
That's great. Well, thank you for that roundup, Kurt. I mean, the cardinal rule was always a joke.
I know.
That we didn't, do things about birds or any wildlife, but we clearly do things about wildlife all the time because it interacts with our cities and our built world so much that they're actually interesting design conundrums that come about when it comes to the interaction of humans and animals. And, we have like a whole section in our book about it. It is a huge preoccupation of the people on the staff. So
it's a favorite topic of mine too. Like I love animals and I love the built environment. So I love places where they intersect.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, thanks so much for this little extra information, Kurt. I appreciate it.
Of course.
"99% Invisible" was produced this week by Alexandra Lang with Chris Berube, Keiko Donald, and Kurt Kohlstedt. Editing by Delaney Hall. Mix and tech production by Martin Gonzalez. Music by our director of sound, Swan Rial. The rest of the team includes Vivian Lay, Christopher Johnson, Lasha Madon, Jason DeLeon, Joe Rosenberg, Emmett Fitzgerald, Sophia Klatsker, and me, Roman Mars. Alexandra Lang first wrote about bird-safe design for Bloomberg CityLab. We'll include a link to this article and more of Alexandra's writing at 99pi.org. Special thanks this week to Elizabeth Shapiro, Dan Pazzelli, Garrett Crow, NYC Audubon, Flap Canada, and our birders, Jared Thorpe and Catherine Quayle. We are part of the Stitcher and SiriusXM podcast family, now headquartered 6 blocks north in the Pandora Building, in beautiful Uptown Oakland, California. You can find the show and join discussions about the show on Facebook. You can tweet at me at Roman Mars and the show at 99pi.org. We're on Instagram and Reddit too. You can find links to other Stitcher shows I love, as well as every past episode of 99pi at 99pi.org.
Stitcher, Sirius.
I can't make Sirius XM sound like a bird. Sirius XM.